You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest in the studio is Paula Gunn Allen, an anthologist who has put together a collection of traditional tales and contemporary writing by Native American women called Spider Woman's Granddaughters, which has just been published in paperback by Fawcett. Tell me, how did this collection, what was its origins?
Beacon Press brought it out in hardback. And my editor, I had done a book called The Sacred Hoop with Beacon. The subtitle is Recovering the Feminine in American Indian Traditions. And since I'm a poet and a novelist and a critic and a scholar and so forth and so on, and The Sacred Hoop was essays about Native American women's literature as well as some other kinds of things, Joanne Wyckoff at Beacon called and said, would you like to do an anthology of American Indian women short stories? Would I like to? Listen. And I had just been thinking about it maybe a couple, 3 weeks before. I had been doing a review of a book by Beverly Hungry Wolf and her husband, I can't remember the name, Children of the Sun. And in it, they had done some stories that had been written at Carlisle Indian School. Oh, early, I guess, in this century, my great-grandmother had gone there. And I didn't know that there were these stories that had been published in the newspaper at the Indian school, but they were very moving, wonderful stories. So I was thinking, gee, wouldn't it be grand to be able to put together an anthology like this, you know, and of these stories? Well, I never was able to locate any more of the stories, and so none of them find their way into this collection. So maybe that's the next anthology.
This goes from oral traditions and storytelling to written traditions. Mm-hmm. And so in a certain sense, it goes from stories that anthropologists have gathered in the fields to stories that you have gathered from among the shelves, and you become a kind of human anthropologist.
Dreadful thought.
A human anthropologist, who would want that? Were any of these stories found expressly for this volume that had never been published before?
One of them was written expressly for this volume. That's the last story. What is the name of that? Stories Have No Endings. My story, Deep Purple, had never been published before, but it's part of a novel that some other chapters had been published. Mary Tall Mountain's story, can't remember the name of it, it's about Mary Jo Beauchanan and her children, and Sister Celeste and her children. I combined two short stories put them into one of Mary Tall Mountain's work. That's part of a novel that she's been writing since the early 70s. We've been working on it, well, I've been working with her on it, and I don't think more that, I think maybe one very small other section, very tiny section of that novel had been published before, but the story that's in Spider Woman's Granddaughters had not been published.
You say in your introduction that many of the writers, whether they are conscious practitioners or not, are contributing to tale cycles. What are tale cycles?
Well, let's see. Let me go back up. There's something called the oral tradition mm-hmm. among Native people. Actually, there's something called the oral tradition among anybody. But it's kind of an important consideration among Native American people because it's still alive. And, you know, your sense of who you are has an awful lot to do with not only the story that you tell yourself all the time about who you are, but it has to do with the stories that you heard about who you were or who your folks were or who your family is or who your people are or what happened in the world or what reality is like. You know, nobody knows what reality is like. We haven't the vaguest idea, but we have a story, and we have these large communal stories. Like you and I have a communal story that we share right now. It's called Radio Station. And so we can have a radio show because we have this story. Well, we don't have it alone, of course. thousands and thousands and thousands of people have had it for, you know, half a century now, so or a century, so we can have a radio show. Well, it's like that. We have an oral tradition, and that tradition tells us who we are as a people and where we've been and what reality is about. So when those oral stories, which are presently still being told, they're contemporary, get into your head, and then you come from a particular tradition, say Navajo, or say Iroquois, or Cherokee, or in my case, Laguna Curies in the Southwest, what informs your writing is your oral tradition. And that's true for Western writers as well. It's just that their tradition is, Faulkner's oral tradition is biblical, for example, and it's Southern as well, and it's university. You see what I mean. And that, so that's going to inform The Sound and the Fury, for instance. What's going to inform American Horse, a story in this collection by Louise Erdrich, is her own Chippewa oral tradition, what she grew up hearing, and how she understands people to be, and what she understands is motivating to people, and what gives purpose to their lives, and how their relationships are formed, and what's valuable in the relationship. And that's going to have a lot of echoes in the oral tradition of the Chippewa people. So the reason I put traditional stories in this collection of contemporary stories was so that readers could see how that works.
In the transition between traditional story and written story, you do see in these stories by Native American women collected in Spider Woman's Granddaughters a tendency to celebrate the animistic universe, the universe of animate objects and creatures and weather and states of consciousness. I wondered whether in some way the prevalence of magic realism fiction from South America was also perhaps an influence on some of these writers, like Louise Erdrich.
You know, that's an interesting idea. There's a writer whose name, a Native American writer whose name is James Welch, and it's said that he's been influenced by Cesar Vallejo. And Vallejo is supposed to be a surrealist, but of course that's ridiculous. He's not a surrealist, he's an Indian. You know, and what the French would call surreal, or what the American establishment might call surreal, is simply how Native people perceive the world. It's not, there's nothing surreal about it. I don't know what it is, but for us it's realism.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, where I come from, the truth is, I'm not the only thinking animal. The truth is, where I come from, that the only thinking being in existence is thinking woman, who is called Grandmother Spider. And the reason that we exist is because she's thinking of us right now. We're just thoughts in her, you know, her thought stream. And they say that she's the only creative thinker because she's the only one that can bring something from nothing whatsoever. So, and we think that all of the animals think. We think that trees think and thunderstorms think, that they're self-aware and they're intelligent, and their behavior is purposeful. Now, that sounds really surrealistic or Jungian or something, you know, to the Western rationalist mind. But to the Indian mind, it's not. So back to Erdrich or whoever, Welsh or Paula Gunn Allen, for that matter, what I see in the work of South American contemporaries is simply that they recognize the reality that we recognize, because they're either directly part of Native communities, they belong to Native communities, as Vallejo does, or they've been impacted by writers who follow in that tradition. That's true for the Mexican writers, Central American writers as well.
Well, don't you think also that it must be that there is a phase of consciousness which is open to aliveness in all things? Certainly Aesop's fables, you know, begin with a perception that all things have a lesson to teach, and mm-hmm. all things are animate in the revelation mm-hmm. of that intention. One of the things that struck me in this collection, Spider Woman's Granddaughters, is that traditions persist, and so in your story Deep Purple, the woman's group that meets in the story is reinventing or continuing tribal culture.
Reinventing, I think, as much as anything, because I don't think that they understand that that's what they're about.
But that's what the story understands about
them. Yes, that's
them.
What the story understands. And they're still groping, so they think that community is about destruction, that the way you build a community is to destroy another community. And the protagonist, who's a young Indian woman, she knows that's not what you do, and I don't know that she's all that conscious. She's very young, and she does a lot of dope, so I'm not sure that she knows what she's doing. She just does it because her training, her own consciousness, is in that direction. So she goes for connecting and for bridging differences and for bringing people together rather than allowing them to separate.
Do you think that... I'm curious because I come, you know, as a bookworm from an overly educated place where the books that I know best were books I was first subjected to. And then many years later, there were the books that I found myself that became very precious to me. And I think that what led me, oddly enough, into reading Native American literature was Little Big Man. And I wondered what you thought of a book like that.
Personally, well, I can't say about the book because I never read the book. I saw the movie. I saw the movie 5 times when it first came out, and then I showed it in a film class I was teaching a couple of times. I think at the time that I first saw it, I thought it was stupendous. I thought it was magnificent. And then when I showed it again all these many years later, I was struck by the number of concepts from that movie that I incorporated without even knowing where they came from, and which led me to do some re-examining of the premises I was operating on. But I wish I could speak to your actual question about the book itself, the writing of the book. The concept of Jack Crabb is a marvelous notion, and it's so American. You know, I think that the thrust of the story is incredibly American, and it's terribly important. It's not Native American; it's American, but it's beautiful. It's powerful, and it has some kind of terrific meaning about the consciousness of America.
Why women's fiction? What is the what about the woman storyteller that led you to bring together these pieces into a collection, Spider-Woman's Granddaughters?
Well, partly because I teach Native American, a class called Native American Women, and then I teach Native American women's literature. So I've spent a great deal of time being attentive to the literature of Indian women. And there's several reasons for that. One is I'm a woman. Another one is we tend to get ignored in, you know, the sort of usual way. So people put together anthologies of Native writers, and they put the men in, they leave the women out. And then it's called Indian, you know, or Native American, and we're left out. That's part of it. But also part of it is that my editor wanted a collection of short stories by women. She had done another collection from Irish writers, women, and she was sort of planning a series. I think that she got two, and then I think maybe that was all because she went to another press. So I don't know what's going to happen on that. But I certainly tend to see the storyteller as female, though that's not the truth. I mean, lots of men tell stories. You see those little storyteller dolls, and they're always the women. But it's just a question of who's good at telling stories. Who winds up doing the storytelling in a given community or household, for that matter. In my own household, my father tells the stories.
Oh, really?
My father is an incredible raconteur. He'll keep it up for days, weeks, you know. I have tapes of him that nonstop, 8 hours, the man was telling stories. He just loves to tell stories, and his father told me stories. And I would ask him, you know, things. He was from Lebanon, and he would tell me just all these wonderful things. And they're those kind of people who hook up with the geography. So any place that they've been, they had a story connected with that place. I do the same thing.
One last question, and one that I'm sure if you could answer, every writer who listens will be rewarded. What is a story?
What is a story? Isn't that a wonderful question? I tell students, you know, as long as it's a good story, you can do anything you want. But I guess a story is it's an exercise in, what could you say, consciousness, in a way of making perception and sensation and interpretation comprehensible, organized, organizing what we do and what we imagine that we do.
I think that's as good an answer as we can come up with in 30 seconds. I congratulate you for being fearless. I've been talking to Paula Gunn Allen, the editor of Spider Woman's Granddaughters, a collection of traditional tales and contemporary writing by Native American women. Thank you for being with me, Paula.
Thank you.
My second guest today is Charles Johnson, author of a new novel from Athenaeum, Middle Passage. He is the author as well of The Sorcerer's Apprentice, Faith and the Good Time Thing, The Ox Herding Tale, Being and Race, Black Writing Since 1970. It's a book very unusual in its tones about a black man after the Civil War, manumitted, traveling, actually jumping ship on what turns out to be a slave trading vessel on its way to Africa. And it's what befalls him on that voyage, which is a spiritual voyage as well as a literal voyage. How did this novel begin?
It began really in 1971. I wrote six novels before I published the first one, which is Faith and the Good Thing. And I wrote them very quickly, like one every 3 months, because we were a quarter system, and I thought you could write a novel and finish it in a quarter, because I took classes and finished them in a quarter, right? So it was six quick novels, and this was the second one in that series, apprentice novels, I call them, because I wasn't ready to write. But I did the research in 71, that began the research. And I returned to it after I had written something that was published many years later, 83, and took another stab at the story from a more mature perspective, I think, than I had when I was 22 years old. What I wanted to do was several things. I wanted to explore the possibilities of the sea story for African-American literature, because we don't have a black American sea adventure story. I wanted to get those details in about the slave trade, too, because I didn't think most people knew what those were, specifically on the ships, in the hold, the cultural collision that comes from people, when people from one place meet people from another place who are very different. The slaves on the ship, the Almuseri, do not exist in the real world. I invented the tribe. And they are very spiritual, non-Western people. I think this is very important in the book. And Calhoun, who is a black American, freed, it is before the Civil War in 1830, you know, just 20 years before the Civil War, just about. He is, you know, he's not like them either, you know, coming from the West. And so he has an encounter not only with his African heritage, so to speak, but with a profoundly moral and spiritual people at the same time.
The original title of the novel was Rutherford's Travels when it was published in a couple of different literary magazines, suggesting that there was at one time a strong satirical underpinning.
Yeah, it seems to echo the working title, Gulliver's Travels.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it was a working title, really, for 6 years. That's how long I worked on the book. But also, in the earlier incarnations of the book, because I worked, you know, many years on it, he did travel to other places. The ship does sight an island, and they get off, and they meet another kind of people other than the Almuseri. But in the final version, I decided it might be dramatically better focused if, after the slaves are taken on board, we stay on the ship until the end of the novel.
One of the most extraordinary events in this novel is the announcement, at least it took me by storm, that that there, in addition to the slaves and the plundering of tribes and traditions and kingdoms, things that are going back to stock museums in America, all under the ministrations of the Yankee trader Ebenezer
Falcon.
Falcon, right. There is an African god on board. This is a stunning thing to happen in a novel, the appearance of a god. I thought I would ask you to read the passage in which the god is first viewed by one of the deckhands.
Okay.
It's Tommy O'Toole who crawls down into the hold in this section from Charles Johnson's novel, Middle Passage.
We were about to lower him when the boy crawled back on deck with only half his mind, or could be it was twice the mind he had had before. His skin was cold, all one bluish color as if he had been baptized in the deep. His face was blank as a pan, and his words, as his mouth spread and closed like a fish's, were strange. A slabber of Bantu patois, Bushman, Cushitic, and Sudanic tongues, and your guess where he learned them is as good as mine. His eyes glowed like deck lights, less solid orbs of color, if you saw them up close, than splinters of luciferin indigo that, like an emulsion, had caught the camphor of a blaze once before them. With Kringle's waistcoat shawled over his shoulders for warmth and holding a horn of rum in his hands, Tommy found a space in his sporadic madness to tell us how he'd come within 3 feet of forcing open a door in the crate after the rope broke, but was stopped by the density of air around it, a natural defense of the thing inside, which did not so much occupy a place as it bent space and time around itself like a greatcoat. He could force his bare feet to go no farther. This was just as well. For dark coils of the creature's defecation were everywhere, slithering with insects, worms, and slug-like beings that apparently lived inside its bowels. All at once, the crate rocked gently as something crab-walked from one side of the box to the other, scritching its nails on the walls, muttering to itself like a devil chained inside a mountain for 1,000 years, its voice gently syllabled and honeyed, as sacramental as a siren's, or peradventure its very breathing was a chant, so full of love and weirlight, Vatic lament and Vedic sorrow, that the boy's heart bade him listen more. He slapped his left hand over his mouth, clamped his right hand over the left, and bent down on one knee, this being a brain-rinsing song the boy somehow felt he knew. Down in that lichen chamber, down in the shrunken air scattered with galley wood and bosun stores, down in a vault swimming with imponderables, he forgot where he was and why he had come. A sea change nicer than any of us knew, he said. And then the creature's lay whistled from his own lips, like the sweetest of fluids whelming through his windpipes, and he was inside the luminous darkness of the crate, himself chained now, yet somehow unchained from all else, sadly watching young Tommy O'Toole, sensing as if through the lotic skin of a stingray or crab. And they were a single thing, singer, listener, and song, light spilling into light, the boundaries of inside and outside, here and there, today and tomorrow, obliterated as in the penetralia of the densest stars or at the farthest hem of heaven. When he had finished, his eyes a shimmer after peering into the heart of things hidden and his body swaying to music none but he could hear, after this there was no sound forward and aft except the creaking of rigging loud as a bonfire. Blimey! A deckhand ran his fingers through his hair. It eats people, that's what it eats. Squib, the cook, was tight as usual, trying to stand erect, weaving on both feet, tilting first left, then right. He lifted the cross from his neck, and his eyes closed. He kissed it. Saints preserve us. A few chaps shivered, and not simply from the wind's chill gnawing through our coats. All could see the ship's boy would never come about. He was lost to us.
Charles Johnson, reading from his novel Middle Passage, recently published by Athenaeum. Now, it must be very hard to bring a god on stage.
I didn't expect to do that when I began the book, but I knew... that in Chapter 3, something was needed to up the ante. I mean, we had the slaves on board, and I was writing all day long, and I couldn't figure out what was needed. And I went to take a nap, and in that place where you're just half conscious and half asleep, seriously, I saw this image of something huge being brought onto a ship. I didn't know what it was. I mean, I didn't know what it was, literally. And in the beginning, when this is first talked about in the novel, the sailors don't know what's in the crate either. And it occurred to me, it's a god. What else could it be? It's their god, right? And this guy's got it. And he's an American soldier of fortune. And he has captured the force that holds the universe together.
It is a philosophical novel, too, full of disquisitions about, substance and surface and substance and mind and body, and has as one of its epigraphs the line from the Upanishad, "Who sees variety and not the unity wanders on from death to death." This really is a novel about a man who goes backwards in order to be reborn. It's a very lovely novel, and we wish it, you know, great success here. What are you working on now?
At the present time, I'm thinking about the next novel and working on two new books for Indiana University Press, which published Oxford and Tale, my previous novel. The first book is called Black Writers on Writing, and it's a collection of essays by 15 writers, contemporary writers of fiction, on how they became writers, their aesthetic, and what they think of contemporary literature. I'll do the editing and introduction. And the second book is called Black Male in America, which I'm editing with novelist John McCluskey at Indiana University. And as the title suggests, it's about the sort of critical situation that young black males find themselves in now, between the ages of 16 and 24, almost a lost generation. So our hope is to get, you know, psychologists, social anthropologists, all these people who are concerned about the issue to write about it in fresh ways. I have a son who's 15, so I think about this a lot, and that those essays won't be done until next year. But the other book should be out by next year, the one on black writing.
I've been speaking to Charles Johnson, author of Middle Passage, a novel recently published by Athenaeum. This is Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, books.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.